Ladies and gentlemen, we would now like to inform you that you can see beautiful northern lights out on the port side. Mine damer og herrer, vi vil gjerne få informere om at vi nå kan se vakkert nordlys på skipets babordside.
Hello, I'm Ian Ridpath. I'm the astronomy lecturer on the Hurtigruten Astronomy Voyages. The Northern Light, well, Northern Lights and Aurora are just two different names for the same thing, so you know you can call them either. But the origin lies 93 million miles away on the Sun. And the Sun emits streams of atomic particles which are funneled down by the Earth's magnetic field into a ring around the poles, the North Pole and the South Pole. And so to see an aurora, you really have to go far enough north or south to get under one of these ovals. And it's actually much easier to go north, because if you go south, you're in Antarctica. And the strength of, it's called the solar wind, there's this stream of atomic particles. And the strength of the solar wind varies with activity on the Sun. So sometimes you get much more intense aurorae than at other times. And on this particular trip, we were very lucky a couple of nights ago to get a wonderful display which went on for a number of hours, beautiful moving shapes which people were out on deck very enthusiastically photographing, because with modern digital cameras, it's actually really quite easy to photograph these things and put them on your Facebook page and make your friends very jealous. So basically, it's the flow of electrons from the Sun hitting the Earth's upper atmosphere and making it glow and producing these ghostly glowing shapes which we call the Northern Lights. And we are going to have to stop there.
My name is David LeConte, and I come from the island of Guernsey, where I was born, and I now live in Guernsey again, although having lived for the best part of 20 years outside of Guernsey, particularly in the United States of America.
David, what first got you interested in astronomy?
Well, my first recollection of being aware of the stars was probably when I was 5 or 6, immediately after the war. I was evacuated from Guernsey during the German occupation of the island, returned in 1945, and of course, with a blackout, you couldn't have bonfire nights, couldn't have Guy Fawkes nights, fireworks, but I can remember my very first one when rockets were being sent up. And I asked the adults around, how high do the rockets go? Do they go above the trees? Yes, of course they do. Do they go up to the stars? And nobody seemed to know the answer to that. They sort of gave me, so they were going amongst the stars, but it didn't sound very convincing. So after that, I got interested, particularly as a teenager, and particularly trying to learn my way around the constellations, and also how things moved in the solar system. And that was fascinating to me. And then I pursued it when I was at university and took some astronomy courses as part of my physics degree, and then got involved with the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh. I volunteered.
We have a message for passenger Kevin Mack. Kevin Mack, please contact reception at deck number 3. Thank you.
I volunteered to work with a small team that was tracking satellites, because satellites were fairly new then. I'm talking about the early 1960s. First satellite was launched in 1957. And
we also have a message for passenger Dennis O'Donoghue. Dennis O'Donoghue, please contact us. Number 3, thank you.
So they were tracking satellites to look at what you call the perturbations of the orbit of the satellite around the Earth, from which you can tell something about the shape of the Earth itself, and the way that its gravity varies over the surface of the Earth, and as well as things like upper atmosphere drag. There's a little bit of atmosphere even at the high altitude that satellites orbit. So I did that for a bit, and that got me to work not just as a volunteer, but some holiday work at the observatory, which then led on to working for a while at the University College in Aberystwyth in Wales, developing a satellite tracking camera. So this was my interest, and that then led on to working in America, because the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, which is part of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington DC, although the observatory is based co-located with Harvard College Observatory in Massachusetts, and they were looking for people to help man what was then the most powerful camera in the world, It stood about 8 feet tall, weighed 3 tons, had a 20-inch aperture lens. It was a telescopic camera, basically, mounted in three directions so that it could follow satellites, and it could photograph a thing the size of a grapefruit at 3,000 miles. So very, very powerful. And so I applied and was accepted, went to work there. We did a lot of satellite tracking as well as astronomical observations, particularly of stars that flare up suddenly, and also comets, things like that. But we were tracking satellites for scientific purposes, really. But then we tracked, of course, the Apollo spacecraft when they were going up. We're talking about the late 1960s then. We had 12 stations with these cameras around the world. I worked in Florida and in Hawaii on the top of 10,000 foot volcano in Hawaii, Haleakala, which is a dormant volcano, fortunately, and then in Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona, where we had an observatory there, a fairly new observatory, which is now called the Whipple Observatory. And so I did a lot of work with astronomers at that time. And then I went to, was asked to go and work at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., to administer research projects that curators were undertaking around the world, mainly, in what we then called third world countries, India, Sri Lanka, and so forth, and did a lot of traveling at that time, mainly in natural history, but some astrophysics as well. Yeah. And then in 1975, I was...
Ladies and gentlemen, at 10 o'clock there will be a point of interest outside of deck number 5, and you will learn more about the island of Munkholmen and its history.
Okay, I was waiting for the German line.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in 1975, I was asked to go to the Kitt Peak National Observatory, which was the national observatory of the United States, in Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah.
And this was a fascinating place to work because we had astronomers from all over the world coming through the observatory doing observations with the one of 13 telescopes which we had on the mountain there, about 5,000 feet up. And I was in management then, so I was managing a department in the observatory, and that was a fascinating place to be. So then I returned to Guernsey in 1978 and helped to found the small observatory that we have there, run by a local society, and so I'm now very much an amateur astronomer, but very keen. But I'd never really seen the Northern Lights properly, so that's what got me onto this trip.
Fascinating. So tell us about your experiences of the Northern Lights during this trip.
Well, it's been quite incredible that I thought we'd be lucky to see the Northern Lights. I was on this trip once before when we saw nothing at all because it was cloudy. And then this time we thought we'd give it another go and did the round trip, in fact, instead of just the one way, giving us a better chance. And also joining an astronomy group here led by Ian Ridpath, who I knew slightly. And so we joined this trip, expecting we might possibly see it once, but we've seen it on several successive nights, and it's been incredible. Last night was amazing displays, and I was amazed how bright it got sometimes, how it constantly changed, and hopefully I got some decent pictures of it. So I'm quite satisfied now that I have seen the Northern Lights in all their glory, and they are certainly worthwhile seeing. An amazing sight.
They are, aren't they? You've had an absolutely fantastic career, haven't you? And what would you say to any budding young astronomer or any aged hobby astronomer out there about, you know, what you can do with that hobby?
Well, first of all, just look up. Astronomy is all about looking up, and I sometimes say it's like having a a garden with beautiful flowers just outside your house and never looking at, through the window at them, even. We have the beautiful stars and the universe and all the wonderful things that it contains. So I would say, people ask me what kind of telescope they should get and what kind of telescope I have. I've never had a telescope. That's because I've always been able to use much better telescopes than I could buy.
Yeah.
And at our small observatory in Guernsey, for example, we have a 16-inch Meade telescope and another 5-inch refractor and other telescopes, which are incredible and very, very, you can see wonderful things with them.
Yeah.
And so I would say join a local society if you're really interested. Mm-hmm. Get a pair of binoculars to start off with and use them for a year. If you're then interested, then think about getting a telescope. But also, if you're interested in pursuing it academically, then mathematics is a very important part of it, physics. And just go for it, really. And people these days, astronomers these days, are all very specialized. They have their own speciality, particular kinds of stars or particular kinds of problems of the universe. And so find something that really interests you and pursue that. And look at courses at universities and courses in school that you could do to further your interest.
Yeah. And what would you say in your lifetime has been an astronomical highlight for you, something that's happened up there that's kind of blown your mind, you know, with all your intellect and your knowledge, something that's made you feel very tiny as a human?
Well, comets have always fascinated me because even faint comets are interested, and there are lots of comets discovered every year, but we don't hear about them because they're mostly very faint and you need a large telescope to see them. But occasionally a very bright one comes along. There was a very bright one in 1960s called Akiyosuke, and there was, of course, Comet Hale-Bopp in 1997, which maybe many people remember.
I remember that one. It was like a smudge, wasn't it, in the sky? It was beautiful.
It was like a beacon for there, and it was there for weeks. It was it was wonderful. And we never know when another bright comet like that might come around. So those are interesting. But I think the thing that really was the most amazing thing I'd ever saw. Was when I was working on Mount Haleakala in Maui, Hawaii, and we had one of these cameras, as well as we had a very powerful laser system that we were tracking satellites with. But we had the chance to photograph an event which was unique at that time, in that it was the Apollo 8 spacecraft, and this year is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 8, which was a Christmas launch, just before Christmas, and they were going around the moon at Christmas time. This is the very first time that man had ever been to the moon, not landing, but going around the moon as a practice and a trial for Apollo 11, which did land on the moon the next year. So we were in the position in the middle of the Pacific to see what was called the translunar injection, which was after the spacecraft had gone around the Earth a couple of times. They then fired the rockets and sent it out towards the moon. And we managed to get, with our camera, we managed to get something like 80 pictures in 2 minutes of this event. And they were absolutely remarkable pictures. And they are the only ones that exist of this event. Even NASA, which had its own aircraft carrier in the Pacific as a recovery vessel, didn't take any pictures themselves. So
really?
We have, and in fact, I had a hotline set up from our station through our headquarters in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to Houston, where they were being controlled, and the astronauts on the Apollo 8 spacecraft were informed that we had, in fact, observed them from Hawaii at the time that we observed them. So that was quite exciting.
That's amazing.
And it was an amazing sight, this burning of this, or suddenly you could see the jets streaming out from it in a couple of directions. It was a bit like, I thought it was a bit like two comets joined at the head, as it were, and racing through the sky. And it was wonderful. We tracked them until they disappeared over the horizon and went off to the moon.
Fascinating. I also also see objects which are moving and then they very slightly change trajectory. Are they satellites?
They could well be satellites, yes. Satellites, there are many thousands of satellites, so you can see a lot of them. Some of them are very faint, some of them are very bright. And the brightest one is the International Space Station by far.
Yeah.
And there's a very good website called Heavens Above, which you can put in your location in the website, and then it'll give you predictions of when lots of satellites are visible. And the space station particularly is about the size of a football field, so it's extremely bright. And it appears to go over about the speed of a plane, but it doesn't flash lights or anything like that. So you can tell when it goes over. They generally go from west to east.
Okay, that's good to know. What do you think the chances have been or are of intelligent life out there somewhere?
Well, in recent years, in the last 20 or so years, we've started discovering what are called exoplanets, planets going around other stars other than the Sun. And we have found that, in fact, lots of stars have such planets, and some of the planets look like they might be somewhat Earth-like, and though they need to be in the what we call the Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold, where the Earth is, and they need to have the right conditions to for form life. But I think with the trillions and trillions of stars that there are, I mean, there are something like 100,000 billion galaxies, each containing 100,000 billion stars on average. So the chances of there being other Earths out there and other people, intelligent life having developed on those planets, are quite high, really. Whether we will ever hear from them or whether they will ever hear from us, I don't know. But I'm convinced that the chances are that there must be. You can do estimates. There may be just a few, or there may be millions and trillions of them.
Yeah.
We don't know. But it's and there's been so much learnt during my lifetime about. I mean, I would never have thought that we would have vehicles trundling around on Mars, for example, or visiting the outer parts of the solar system. And feeding back all the information that we've had. So this is all being developed as we speak, and so there's only a matter of time before we do find the perfect planet out there somewhere.
We make friends, or not.
Sorry?
And we make friends with them, or not.
Oh, well, yes, that's if they make contact. Yes.
Yeah.
The chances, though, of contact are rather slim because the distances are so great.
Yes.
And of course, even the speed of light is a finite, and you can't go any faster than that. And so, it's the communication. You know, could take a long, long time, like thousands of years, to get an answer back. So, we don't know.
We just don't know. Ian, what inspired you to go into astronomy?
I think when I was a kid, all kids are interested in, usually in space, racing cars and dinosaurs, and most of them grow out of it, but I never grew out of the interest in astronomy. And I remember watching Patrick Moore on the Sky at Night when I was a kid, and, you know, of course he went on for years and years and years. So I suppose, you know, he inspired me, and also at the time I was growing up was the start of the space age, when the first Sputniks and satellites were launched into orbit, followed by the first humans in orbit, and so it was a fascinating time to grow up, and eventually I turned what was really my hobby into a profession and became a writer, and I write mostly about astronomy.
Lovely. How did you get into the field of astronomy, as in qualifications?
I'm entirely self-taught. I'm a hobby astronomer.
Yeah.
And when I started quite some decades ago, scientists didn't talk to the media. It was considered very infra dig to get yourself too much publicity. And it could actually ruin your reputation for if you spoke to the press. Now, that's changed completely because every university has a publicity officer who's only too keen to get their researchers into the press, and indeed researchers these days are very good at presenting their own work. But so when I started, you know, journalists were still necessary to help scientists interpret their work for the public. And of course, they themselves do it very well now. So I probably couldn't have the same career again if I was starting now.
What has been the highlight of your career?
The highlight of my career, well, actually, one of the things I really enjoy doing now is lecturing on ships. Because to me, it's just another way of getting across information about astronomy. And I'm doing it by the spoken word rather than the written word. We do a number of cruise ships, but for the past 8 years now, I've been doing Northern Lights trips to Norway with the Norwegian coastal route, which is called Hurtigruten. And indeed, it was on a Hurtigruten ship that we first met back in 2011 on a Northern Lights trip. So that's exciting. It's able to, you do real observing with people who've always wanted to see the Northern Lights. I mean, all the surveys all show that one of the top things on everybody's bucket list is to see the Northern Lights. So Northern Lights cruises are now becoming very popular, and we get groups of 50, sometimes more, from Britain, the United States, quite a number of Aussies and New Zealanders as well, all coming up to Norway to see the Northern Lights. And in my view, Norway is the best place to see the Northern Lights from.
So if you do the Hurtigruten, you have a chance of seeing the Northern Lights and falling in love.
Ah.
What? I wouldn't quite describe it.
Falling in love with the Northern Lights, right. Perhaps, yes. Yeah. Well, it does become addictive, you know, because they're different every time, and people just do keep coming back.
Within the realm of astronomy, have there been any momentous occasions where you've kind of, your mind has been blown by something happening out up there?
Well, I have to admit that I haven't actually discovered anything myself, but I think I've lived through an era where the planets have been visited by, every planet has now been visited by a space probe, from Mercury right out to Pluto. And of course, actually, Pluto has been declassified as a planet and is now considered a dwarf planet rather than a proper planet. But all the bodies have been visited by space probes. So they've gone from being just little blobs of light in a telescope to real worlds, which we've seen in close-up and in some cases have even landed on them. So I think this has been a tremendously exciting time to be alive. And of course, I also remember living through the moon landing. And next year is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, and we have this new film with Ryan Gosling playing the part of Neil Armstrong, the man who was the first person to land on the moon. So just simply seeing humans landing and walking on the moon was one of the most extraordinary things in my lifetime. And it's really rather a pity that we haven't gone back, and I hope in the next few years that we will and start to set up permanent moon bases to do proper scientific exploration, rather than it just being a political ploy, which the Apollo missions really were.
Yeah, the race and all of that.
The race between America and Russia. It was the Cold War played out in space.
Mm. And who won the PR?
Well, the Russians were winning eventually, but then the Americans decided to do something which even the Russians couldn't manage to do. So they sort of lost interest and pretended they hadn't been trying.
Not that bothered.
No, you can't put someone into orbit without someone else knowing. Which is, again, one of the weaknesses of conspiracy theory, because some people say the Americans didn't land on the moon. Well, unfortunately, there is very good independent evidence that they did. And, of course, the Russians would have known if the Americans hadn't gone to the moon. They would have blown the whistle on them. So, you know, it's not something that you can do quietly, putting spacecraft into orbit. And, of course, what people now forget is that the media were crawling all over NASA at the time, because they were doing it in the full glare of publicity, whereas the Russians always did things first without telling anyone, and then once they'd done it, they'd admitted it.
The cloak and dagger, I love that. Sheila, what have been the highlights of your Hurtigruten? So you've done quite a few, I assume, since you first met.
Yes, buying wool.
Buying wool.
Tell us about your wool purchasing. And I'm not even joking. What have you bought? You bought some alpaca. Yes,
this trip
red.
I bought alpaca. Yeah. I have to say I'm just collecting more and more wool, and I'm not knitting it as quickly as I'm collecting it. Now, what I have found quite interesting on the Hurtigruten is that you actually get into the Norwegian culture. And one of the things that Norwegians do is knit, and it reminded me that I had forgotten knitting. I used to knit a lot, and I was taught when I was a very small child. And Norway just has stunningly beautiful wool shops. So when I get home, I'm there translating Norwegian knitting patterns into English. And they also knit in a different way. They knit in the round, so it's a different way. Not just the words, you actually have a different sort of construction.
Fantastic.
So it's quite interesting.
So you've
but they're very beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. And what would you say about the Northern Lights and the astronomy tour in general?
Well, I am a bit biased, but I did go originally as a passenger.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fantastic way of seeing not only the Northern Lights, but getting yourself into the Norwegian culture. You actually see all the small towns, you get some idea of what it's like to live in the Arctic Circle. We've seen some absolutely fascinating things. I'm particularly fond of the High Arctic, and we've seen sea ice forming in Kirkenes. We've gone ashore at Kirkenes, which is right by the Russian border, on a Sunday morning, and seen people, instead of mowing the lawns, they've got their snow blowers out and they're blowing the snow away. Walking in Honningsvåg, which is still very north, seeing dogs being taken for a walk with kick sleds, snowmobiles parked outside shops, kick sleds with baskets, wicker baskets tied onto them, pushed by little old ladies. Fantastic.
Sounds so evocative and romantic. No wonder you fell in love.
Yes, it's a very different way of life, and it's a very harsh way of life, and you do sometimes wonder how they manage to stick it. You know,
that's human nature, isn't it? Wherever you put us, we will try and thrive.
And they do, yes.
And part destroy everything, but that's a whole different 3 hours of... I've just been playing with Archie in the playroom, giving him a little stretch so he can roll over and do baby things, when all of a sudden we hear the bing bong. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to go to deck 5, the aft, the Northern Lights are in the sky. I tell you what, I have never packed up and padded this baby in a massive polar suit as quickly as just now. I'm literally wearing a cardigan, and we have rushed out to deck 5. And to look at the sky, it's, you think they're clouds, because they're not that bright, because our eyes have been inside, so we're not used to the darkness yet. But if you take your camera with a slow shutter speed and pap them, then they will come out that beautiful green. And in front of us, there is a huge smudge from the sea to the sky, an arc of this cloud, what looks like. And in the photographs, oh, you can see every detail. You can see rays and ribbons. I've got some dark blue, some greens. The elusive aurora is red, and that's when oxygen is being used up in the process. There's no red today, but it is only 5:05, and it's pitch black outside. So I'm hoping that tonight is the night, Archie, that we get our fill of aurora. And it's literally the most hilarious thing. You hear the bing bong and the announcement, and literally everyone gets up from whatever they're doing and stampedes to the decks. So I've currently left a lot of toys and stuff in the playroom. People leave their drinks, they just grab their coats. We're all here for that one thing, and it's the once in a lifetime Northern Lights experience. You can go down south for the Aurora Australis, but you have to go on Antarctica for it. So if you want the Aurora Borealis, you need to get into the Arctic Circle.
Okay, my name is Barbara. I'm from Germany, but I live in South Africa.
So if you come all the way from South Africa to Norway?
Yes, actually yes. First I flew to Germany to visit my mother, and then I came here
and
to be on the cruise.
Fantastic. And why have you chosen to come, you know, in the darkest, longest, dark days of the winter?
Northern Lights. That was the reason why I booked the trip. To see the Northern Lights.
And have you seen the Northern Lights anywhere else in the world?
No, that was my first time, because I've never seen them. In Germany, I was never lucky. Sometimes you can see them from Northern Germany. And in South Africa, you're at the wrong place.
Yeah.
So I decided to try it to come here and try to see the Northern Lights. That was the reason why I'm here.
Yeah. What have you experienced of the Northern Lights so far?
Yes, yeah, we had a few nights with some light activity, unfortunately also with a lot of cloud, but still we had a lot of activity already, and it was beautiful to see, especially last night. Everybody was asleep. I think I was one of the only ones watching, and you could see the streaks all over the sky. It was magnificent.
What kind of time was that?
It was after 1:30.
In the morning?
In the morning, yes.
And did you choose to go out on deck?
Yes, I stood outside. I mean, you have to stand outside, obviously. I stood outside at the darkest place on the ship, where you had quite a good view. There were no harbour, no port, no lights.
Yeah.
And I could watch it beautifully. Yeah. The clouds were coming and going, and then the clouds were coming in again. Then I stopped, but I could see it bright over all over the sky, up to above us, all these streaks of light moving.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So is that clear that you could see the movement?
Yes.
And the swaying of them.
Yes, yeah.
Did you see any of the red with your eyes?
No.
Because that's really difficult to see, isn't it?
The only colour I could see was grey.
Yeah, yeah. And that's such a myth, isn't it? You know, everyone comes to the Northern Lights and they expect to see that huge kind of neon green fluorescent vibe.
Maybe there are some people who are able to see it. I'm not. For me, so far, everything has been grey.
But then with the camera...
That's a different story.
So when it comes to life. Have you been photographing
them
as well?
Yes. I also brought my camera with the tripod, and I took pictures, and on the pictures you can see the green very nicely and also some red.
Fantastic. And so you've got some beautiful memories and images of it as well.
That's right. Yes, yeah. Last night I couldn't take any pictures because it was extremely windy and the ship was rolling. So that means taking images means everything is smeared on the image because of the movement. So it was much better just to watch it.
And just to be in the moment.
Exactly.
And to enjoy it.
Yes.
Eva, you're a tour guide. What are the highlights of your career? What have been the wonderful things that have happened?
I think probably the best part of my job is the fact that I get to meet people from all over the world. Very, very interesting people. I've met some people that have just taught me so much. You learn so much from people that are of the generation that travels mostly at the time. And I've met a lady who was 80 years old and got on a Russian submarine to the North Pole. I've met one of the gentlemen who worked on the flag that went on the moon.
Oh, wow.
And I've met a gentleman who actually made it to the North Pole at the age of 60.
Oh, gosh.
So I think the people is what makes this job fascinating. It's the most interesting part of the job.
Can you tell us about Norway, about the trip to the Arctic Circle?
Well, I think the trip along the coast of Norway is... It's something that I had to actually wait quite a long time before I discovered myself. And it is always changing. It's never the same. It doesn't matter what time of year, there's always something beautiful, even in the winter when it gets dark and you don't really see the sun for a few days. I think that the reason why I would love for more people to come in and see Norway is just that fascinating nature, the unexpected... You never really know what you're going to get along the coast.
Mm. What's your favourite area from the south of Norway up to the Arctic Circle? What's your favourite stretch?
My favourite stretch? Well, I have a few. Of course, I have to, as a person living in Bergen, I have to say that, of course, it's my favourite city because it has everything it needs to. It's not too big. You can walk across the town from one side to the other, but it has everything you need in a big city. But on the stretch, I would say probably the Lofoten and the Vesterålen Islands, because there's just something about the light up there that is just amazing. In the winter, it's where we normally see the most northern lights. In the summertime, the midnight sun and the light up there makes artists and photographers come up there and have been for years, and some have even settled up there just because they love the light. And it's also this really powerful nature with the jagged mountains and a combination of fjords, mountains, greeneries, beautiful beaches, believe it or not. It's just I think it's the most beautiful stretch of our country, the Lofoten Islands and the Vesterålen Islands.
And what would you say to people chasing the Northern Lights, looking for that one in a million bucket list?
For those who want to come to chase Northern Lights, I think the first thing you have to remember is they're not green when you see them. This is really a good journey to see the Northern Lights. I think all the years I've been doing this, it's only maybe one trip that we didn't see the Northern Lights. Mm. And it's... most important things, okay, first of all, warm clothing, lots of patience, a good camera, because the short little fast photograph cameras won't do. You need a mirror reflex camera with a good lens, and a lot of patience and a couple of prayers from time to time would help also. But I think the most important thing is that you shouldn't have the expectations of seeing the green lights that you see on videos and pictures and so on, because that is not what our eyes see. And also, when you do see them, even though they're not colourful to your eye, they're still fascinating, and to remember to look up and actually enjoy them, not just take the pictures.
Yeah, you have to stop, don't you, and pause.
Yes.
And then they're dancing Absolutely. Around. So I think last night we were in Port, and they were dancing, and I couldn't get many good pictures, which was perfect, because I had to stop and just appreciate the movement and how they change, how fluid they are in the sky.
And absolutely, and I think that is one of the most important things, because people get so focused on taking the pictures.
You need to take them home to show everybody.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, come on, you can Google good pictures of on the internet.
Yeah.
But having seen them, you can't really take a picture of that.
Mm.
You can't really take a good picture of
experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to see it with your own eyes.
Yeah. I have to say, I've absolutely loved this trip, because being part of the astronomy voyage, you've kind of got your hub of people. And I generally love talking to people anyway. Mm-hmm. But on this, it's more of an excuse. You know, like, how's your camera? Got some good pictures? What did you see? And then with those connections, you enter each other's little worlds just for that conversation. It's wonderful.
Yes, I think so. I think the astronomy tours have actually turned out much better than I hoped the first time that I was doing one, because you do have people who are interested in the same thing.
Yeah.
And I hope that everybody feels like they're a little bit special, because we do try to do things for them that are not just part of the regular tour.
And it
creates a special bond, I think, when everybody comes for the same reason.
We have monitors on the boat, and it's the Aurora cameras. So on the left-hand side of the monitor is the Tromsø live Aurora camera from the observation station. And there's a fisheye lens, which is pointing towards the sky. And when there is Aurora, it means that you will be able to see from the horizon to the middle of the sky visually. What, you know, if there's a tinge of green, then that means Aurora's happening. It's updated every 30 minutes. And there's a section which says solar X-rays, whether it's normal, unsettled, or extreme. And there's also geomagnetic field, which is normal, unsettled, or extreme. And so obviously you want extreme for both of those for a high percentage chance of seeing the Northern Lights. And on the right-hand side of the screen, we have an image of the globe from the North Pole, and then where the aurora are happening, there is tinged with green in a circle around the North Pole, and it can go from light green, which means there's 10% chance, all the way up to bright red, which is 100% chance. And as I said, this is updated every half an hour throughout the day and the night. And even if it's daytime, the aurora are always happening if you have enough geomagnetic field unsettlement and enough solar X-rays happening. It's fascinating, and it becomes a huge talking point on the boat. You know, every early evening, people stop, have a look, and have a discussion. What do we think tonight? Will it happen tonight? What time do you think it will happen? Any information? When do we have to run out, quickly dress, run onto the deck and take our photos, and just stand there and watch them? So how were the Northern Lights?
They were so fantastic, indescribable, really. They went up and down, and it was like playing the piano, you know, and it was always colored with red, violet, and yellow, and it really explored into the sky.
Yeah.
It was beautifulest. I've never seen such nature things before. It was all over the ship. It was unbelievable. You didn't know which way you have to move your head because it was all over going around.
Lovely.
It was fantastic.
Oh, so you had a wonderful evening then.
A wonderful night. Yeah. Undescribable.
Jim, you are a biophysicist.
I am.
Tell us about your highlight of the trip.
Well, it was a wonderful trip. Voyage, lots of exciting scenery. But the real highlight was the night when we got absolutely brilliant auroral displays.
Yeah.
Really real-time flashing purple, green, red. Spectacular.